Hello and welcome to another episode of the Rethink Energy podcast, where the Rethink Energy team talk about the technology behind this week's energy news. I'm your host for today, Connor Watts, automotive and battery analyst, and I'm joined yet again by our editor and hydrogen analyst, Bogdan Avramuta.
Hello, everybody.
And by our solar analyst, Andreas Fontenot.
Good morning.
In this week's podcast, we're going to be talking about the Australian Photovoltaic Institute's new solar technology roadmap and how that may change what Australia is producing in the future. Then we're going to be talking about the potential for hydrogen-fired power plants to the tune of about $16 billion worth, and just asking the question as to what impact that can have on the global energy landscape. And finally, we're going to talk a little bit about battery recycling and one company that's really hammering home its main benefit, as it were. So, not to rattle on too much, Andreas, the Australian Photovoltaic Institute's solar technology roadmap, what's it saying Australia should be doing?
So, as I read this through this paper, which I think is 180 pages long, I sort of skim read it in parts, I was quite pleased to have some of my preconceptions confirmed. And this is something that was published by the Australian Photovoltaic Institute recently, APVI, and funded by the Australia Renewable Energy Agency, which is some sort of government body, and supported by a bunch of large industry partners like AGL, Siemens, Tindo Solar, which is Australia's only current solar manufacturer, only at the module segment. Really, the only reason I'm covering Australian solar manufacturing as a concept is because people keep bringing it up. I wouldn't think it would be viable, but it just keeps on having these little bits of news, like the Queenbrook Infrastructure Partners proposal for a polysilicon plant in Queensland. You've got Tindo, which, like I said, is only at the module segment, which is the easiest to reshore or never lose, and they're expanding to 1.5 gigawatts, I think. And now you've got this. And I think Australia's prospects for solar manufacturing are not really much different from America or Europe or a lot of other Western countries. I think it needs typically both the carrot and the stick, which is to say lots of government support in the form, including just money, and also the stick in the form of keeping out Chinese module imports. But what I saw, I was looking through this and I didn't see any references to, oh, by the way, we need to put tariffs on Chinese modules. And so I wrote in this article, oh yeah, well, it seems like they're not advocating tariffs at all. And I guess that's because Australia is in no position to play hardball with China on trade. And then I read a bit further into this big document, and that's exactly what they say at some point. So instead, what they say is we're just going to have to do it with the carrot alone. For the wafer cell module segment, the incentives and subsidies they advocate are not really much different from the IRA. It's basically the same level. But then for polysilicon, they advocate a production subsidy of, I think it's $9.3 per kilogram, which is actually bigger than the price in China. It's something like half of what a healthy price Western manufacturing would be. So it just goes to show that the carrot has to be pretty big if you don't have the stick. You know, this is a fairly long article. There's an interesting table that they have showing the relative advantages of each market when it comes to making things about solar. And perhaps I'll mention a couple of those details. But I just want to get to the conclusion here, which is that it would make sense to – there's always some things that you want to reshore and support and have in your national economy, even if it requires government support. And there's always other things that maybe aren't worth the effort. And I just wonder if solar isn't in the category of things that aren't worth the effort anymore, because the current price is $120 per kilowatt for Chinese modules. At least if you're paying inside China, it probably doesn't increase that much outside. And it just seems like it's not really that valuable. And it's fairly energy intensive, and Australia is energy intensive. And that brings me to one of the details of this comparison that they draw. They point out that obviously, Australia's electricity costs are fairly high right now. And then they say, well, yeah, but look at it. What if you build a brand new solar power plant and use that to power it? Then it's pretty good again because the land isn't too expensive. The irradiation is good and so on. So I just wonder, though, maybe you can comment on this since you're the economist here, Connor. does it make sense to want to reshore this now that it's cheap, especially since people talk about strategic security? And obviously, if a country is selling you fuel, then if that supply gets interrupted, then you have an immediate problem. But if they're selling you the ability to build new power plants and that gets interrupted, it's not really a problem in the same it's not an immediate problem. So what do you think?
Well, first of all, I thought we were keeping that I was the economist on the team up on the down low. But anyways, so as you mentioned there, there's a difference between kind of onshoring something because there's an economic incentive to do so or because there's a strategic incentive to do so. And so it's the sense that I think this sort of thing goes in cycle, a little bit like wartime. Like there's a slightly harrowing theory of that war and industry and all of that. It goes in cycles of what is known and what is forgotten, in the sense that generations following war tend to avoid it at all costs through knowing the consequences through direct ancestors and the ones before them and such. But people who've only known peacetime don't understand the consequences of war, and so have a higher propensity to go towards it. In the sense of strategic industry manufacturing, you have a sense of a really bad thing happens. In the case of the early 2020s, this was COVID-19 and ratcheting trade tensions. And that's drawn a lot of attention towards having your own generation and isolationist policies and onshoring the critical infrastructure. So there's been a shift away from the economic onshoring as the primary reason for it and towards strategic onshoring to say, if supply chains implode again, we aren't going to be as significantly affected as we were when we were caught with our pants down. And so I think for the next 10 years or so, we'll see that there's going to be a significant shift towards onshoring of strategic industries where the carrot is going to be quite big. But that carrot is going to get smaller and smaller and smaller as successive governments just find ways to water it down to spend elsewhere as to whatever fits their particular agenda best. Which that's not necessarily a bad thing. The carrot is outsized in order to kind of fit the risk and kind of the known risk. The problem, as we've seen in Europe and in North America in the past, but recently in Europe with its natural grid, with regards to its natural gas crises, is that you do need some level of constant strategic production. And when you don't have that, things can really hit the fan. So I talked about it a little bit in a piece I wrote just regarding China kind of reining in its excess battery manufacturing.
Because I just said that, why does it matter if our solar module supply gets affected? Because that won't disrupt the existing photovoltaic infrastructure. But I guess that would still be a problem because we're going to have rapid demand growth, electrification, and we still have the agenda to get rid of a lot of existing fossil fuel capacity. So I suppose it would be disruptive. And I think I agree with you from having looked through this roadmap that they are starting to come clear and say and basically imply that it is a political strategic objective. They don't really talk about the politics and strategy so much, but they make that clear instead by being very, very open and honest about, yeah, this needs an enormous amount of support to become viable. Well, in that case, it can't be economically motivated, so it must be strategically motivated. And by the way, I think they don't mention Uyghurs, which is, frankly, kind of a relief, because then you have three different reasons. You've got a moral reason, a strategic reason, and an economic reason. And I always feel like when someone gives you three different reasons for why they want to do something, I just feel like they're bullshitting and they should make up their mind. So it's a relief to have the strategic one come to the fore as the explanation. Another interesting sort of elephant in the room for this report is that they just did it for silicon only. They didn't talk about perovskites, which is a little bit odd because it's pretty likely that perovskites are going to be actually on the market in 2025 and 2026, at least in very small quantities. And once they're in small quantities, they can ramp up very, very swiftly indeed. And perovskites are much less energy intensive to make than silicon. So you would think that this is a way to dodge one of the cost points of Australian manufacturing. Maybe they avoided perovskites because they didn't want to engage with two separate, highly theoretical things at the same time. And also because if they can prove it for silicon PV, that it's viable, then it would implicitly also be even more viable for perovskites. So, sorry, I sort of ranted there, but...
I think it's, at the end of the day, it comes down to a balance of, do you want to spend all this money giving it to the Chinese to get cheap solar panels into the country, obviously with the risk of trade insecurities and whatnot, like Carter mentioned, with what Europe is dealing with at the moment. You don't want to rely your entire economy or a huge chunk of the growth on such a volatile trade partnership, I suppose. But it comes down to either, what's cheaper in the long term, importing them from China with the risk, or importing a bit, setting up some solar capacity that they can power up your own manufacturing capacity. But Andreas, give us an indication of the timeline it would take Australia to build up. I'm not saying matching the Chinese in terms of manufacturing capacity, but getting up to a significant figure, maybe say, I mean, I don't know what significant would count in this sector, but maybe 20, 25, 30 gigawatts. Is that comparable?
So they do have very clear graphs and discussions of the numbers involved. And if you look at my article, I linked their roadmap that I'm working off twice in it. So the initial thing that they advocate is 5 gigawatts by 2030. So, of course, if you start now, you get 2 years to build the first bit a bit more, the Tindo solar modules. And it's got the same sequential delay that was observed, that is being observed with the IRA. Starting out with the modules, then it takes another year to build the cells, because you can't make a cell factory until you have a module factory in the West to sell it to. Otherwise, you would be trying to sell it into China, and that just... it just doesn't work. You would be paying, you wouldn't be able to get a price that would be commensurate with your production costs at all, because the Chinese are only selling for like 10 to 20% above their marginal cost of production, let alone when you put it in Australia. So that means you have to build the modules, wait a year for the cells, wait another year for the wafers, wait another year for the polysilicon, so to speak, and that takes us more or less to 2030. That would be 5 gigawatts. That would only serve... that's basically what Australia's current demand is. So by 2030, it could be very much higher than that. If you're only looking at domestic demand of like the mundane Australian economy as it exists today, it wouldn't need to grow very much beyond that. But you've got electrification. I think we have a fair amount of population growth here. And you also have the prospect of just building a utility scale complex in the Northern Territory or somewhere, and building a 3,000-kilometer cable to Singapore. And some people listening to this might be tempted to roll their eyes at that, but they did say that we're looking at a site in Tasmania to build a factory to make the transmission cabling for that recently. So it's not completely speculative. And beyond that, you also have the possibility for literally hundreds of gigawatts, equal to China's current entire solar capacity, spread around Australia's coasts to make green hydrogen and export it. Although these days, I don't know what your verdict on exporting green hydrogen in sort of tankers is. You might tell me it's a nonsense.
Well, no, it's feasible. Not transporting it as hydrogen, liquid or gas, but as different within different carriers. But yeah, it's totally feasible.
And one last interesting thing, since I was just talking about the sequential development, one interesting thing that is confirmed in this roadmap that has been a little bit ambiguous in our coverage and really everyone's coverage is this concept that China is being restrictive on its exports of wafer production technology. Now, wafer production is the segment where China has 98%. I thought it was 98% of world production, but this report says it's 98.5%. And of course, their facilities are individually far larger. They're the ones that have been built more recently. And so wouldn't you know, they have the cutting edge technology, practical technology, maybe not theoretical science, but certainly in practice, they know how to do it better than anyone else. And this roadmap asserts that it would be difficult for us to get the best stuff out of them, production line equipment. And so this has been a rumor since I think almost an entire year ago. They put out a draft proposal suggesting they might restrict export of wafer production technology, I think covering black silicon as well. And it's then they didn't they didn't publish the actual decision. So I thought they hadn't done it. But there's still people talking as if they might, or even that they're doing it unofficially. And China does do things unofficially. It has the sort of direct arbitrary control over big companies to make them behave that way if they want them to. Also, if you try and log into Chinese social media with a foreign mobile, you're not. They don't tell you that you can't. They just don't. It just doesn't work for you, which is very annoying. And that's an unofficial ban as well. So I just wanted to resolve that sort of mystery. It's a rare point of data. Anyway, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, kind of moving on to the hygiene side of things, as we were talking about then. So, Bogdan, your point here this week is that there's about $16 billion of hydrogen fired power plants. What's the specific info in terms of the generative capacity there?
Yeah, so Germany is essentially issuing a tender worth 16 billion euros to build 10 gigawatts of hydrogen-ready fired power plants. They're essentially gas power plants that could switch to hydrogen in the future. And the operational start date, the aim for this is 2028, so 4 years from now on. I guess I wanted to tackle this because there's a lot of debate around the topic, and unfortunately, there's not a clear answer as to, is this going to take off? Is this not going to take off? Because there's no fundamental issue with replacing natural gas in gas power plants today with hydrogen. There's always the question of efficiency, because obviously you're converting electricity, renewable electricity, into hydrogen, and then you're burning the hydrogen to spin a turbine to generate back electricity. So the round trip efficiency is quite low, something quite horrific. So people use that as kind of the flagship disincentive, rather the flagship and negative of this energy generation method. But really, when you think about it, we use internal combustion engines in cars, and they get less than 50% of the energy out of the petrol, the diesel that we put in them. So I don't think efficiency is such a big driver. People like to make it a big thing because it can be low, but I don't think it's quite like that, because the world, the way the world works today, is quite used to that. So there's never been a disincentive, right? Because if you have enough green hydrogen, then why not? But I guess I was looking more at, with the article, I was kind of analyzing what impact can that have on Germany's decarbonization goals to decarbonize the grid, because this is electricity aimed to supply the grid. And at the moment, Germany has 27.5 gigawatts of gas plant capacity. And I did some calculations, because they've been generating around 95,000 gigawatt hours of electricity. So some quick maths will result in a capacity factor of around 38%. So they don't actually use these gas-fired plants at maximum capacity. There's plenty of countries that use such power plants, maybe 90%, all the way up to 90% of the time. So quite a high capacity factor. Obviously, there's a few reasons for that. So we know that since 2022, since the Russian invasion of Ukraine, Germany's been trying to ease off gas usage. So it makes sense that it's not really burning gas at a maximum rate. It's only more for peaking purposes, to the top of the grid when it needs to. Since it's also shifting away from, well, it has already shifted away from nuclear last year in April, last three nuclear plants shut off. But with this 10 gigawatts of hydrogen-ready capacity, if you were to run on hydrogen from 2028, with a capacity factor of around 9%, it could generate about almost just short of 80,000 gigawatt hours of electricity. So it would be essentially almost enough, those 10 gigawatts, to replace the 27.5 gigawatt hours of gas fire power plants if they were running at a more realistic capacity factor, not just for peaking purposes. So I guess a step in the right direction for Germany. One caveat, though, they do aim to initially, like I said, use those as gas-fired power plants or natural gas in the name to fully transition to hydrogen sometime between 2035 and 2040, which I think is quite ludicrous, because we believe that hydrogen will be in, there will be enough supply of green hydrogen for them to transition earlier than that.
So these are hydrogen-ready power plants, which will... My problem with these tends to just be that it's a bit of a lobby from the oil and natural gas sector and saying, oh, these are hydrogen-ready power plants when the supply is online. And that's money being spent on those rather than increasing the supply of green hydrogen, which means further or continued use of natural gas and a further delay towards what should be a relatively fast transition. It's saying 2035 to 2040 as the point where these are going to be in use. As you say, it's ludicrous, not just from a supply perspective, but from a climate and an electrification perspective.
Yeah, I don't deny that. I don't deny that there might have been some fossil fuel friendly lobbying happening when the decision was taken. I cannot say for certain, but I wouldn't be surprised if that is the case. But I think, you know, to give Germany the benefit of the doubt, I suppose, it's not like they have, you know, it's not like they're building solar and wind, you know, at a rate of a gigawatt a week or something. So I think it's part of that is the uncertainty of, you know, are we actually going to scale up wind and solar resources in time? Are we going to upgrade storage and grid in time in order to shift a lot of this wind resources from the North Sea all the way down in the south of Germany, where most of the industrial activity is happening, where most of the demand is coming from? So I think it's...
I feel like there's also a qualitative difference between the wind, the solar, and the storage on the one hand, and the hydrogen or gas in general on the other. And I think that's the hydrogen is a bit better suited to, well, it's dispatchable. And batteries are kind of dispatchable, but they still require some wind or solar to have come in the past few days. And Germany has this word called Dunkelflaut. I forget what it means, but it means there hasn't been any good solar or wind activity or natural resource for, 3 days, and then you're screwed. And they're fairly far north, so in winter, I guess they would have like a half or a third of the solar output that you might have in the summer. Don't quote me on that, but it's something like that. And they do have good wind resources, but they have to build it in the north and then transmit it to the south, like you say. They are building a fair amount of... You said they're not building 1 gigawatt a week. Well, they are building 1 gigawatt of solar alone each month. So they're kind of getting a little bit close to that. But even when they're building a lot of nominal rated capacity, it's just fairly poor resources. So the amount of generation you get is less than you would get elsewhere. I wonder if the hydrogen is really about seasonal storage and that's kind of security.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think it does hydrogen fire power plants or gas fire power plants. But I guess, you know, we're talking about hydrogen in the context of decarbonization here. They do offer a different grid response, a different degree of dispatchability than wind and solar. So future-proofing, perhaps, having options open, having, you know, like you said, some seasonal storage or, you know, are they still going to run them as peaker plants? I guess part of my calculation was, okay, you're only building 10 gigawatts of these hydrogen-fired power plants. How is that going to replace the 27.5 gigawatts of gas-fired power plants? You know, you can only do it so if you're running it at a high capacity factor. So if they're not going to do that, and if they're only going to, you know, use them as peaking plants, or as, you know, dispatchable seasonal energy, then they need probably a couple more billions invested into such technology.
Or just a market that rewards them a lot for being available, even if they're not used, that kind of thing.
Yeah, but I mean, I was framing that more in the con- context of the, you know, of the of what the grid demands, and, you know, ranking up the numbers, replacing the gas.
Oh yes, yeah. I guess when they've got, it's a bit early to talk about using them only as peakers when Germany still has what I think you say in the article, something like 25%, 30% of its electricity right now coming from coal. So yeah. Natural gas,
which
is
they've ramped up since the pandemic.
Yeah. Yes.
Mm. Well, anyways, moving on. Just a fairly short bit, as we've already overran a tad on boundary recycling. So. A company called Ascend Elements has claimed that they've reduced the carbon footprint of a, I believe it was NMC622, that's nickel manganese cobalt 622 battery, by just under 50% of what it would be to make it through traditional methods, through the use of kind of recycled materials and for green energy, that sort of thing. But Ascend Elements in particular has its, it's called hydrocathode recycling process, which takes a combination of factors, whether that's recycled batteries and clean energy plus a few other things, and it remanufactures the cathode material in a very direct process, which keeps energy consumption low and it keeps the raw material usage quite high. And what was particularly interesting about it is that they can effectively make the cathode material to the specification of any other battery chemistry that uses the same material. So obviously they can't turn kind of nickel into iron and make a nickel manganese battery into an LFP battery, but they can shift from making an NMC622 battery to making an NMC811 battery. That's going to be very useful when end-of-use batteries of existing electric vehicles come into recycling centers, because there's going to be some electric vehicles out there on an NMC532 battery, or 523 battery, sorry. And that's not going to cut the mustard when it comes to 3 to 4 years from now, when that battery is in the scrapyard in the sky. So turning that battery into a useful chemistry is very, very helpful, as in particularly through a direct method, so you don't have to go from ore to battery to ore to battery again. You can just go from ore to battery to battery to battery. And so that keeps the efficiency high. And so what Ascend is targeting is a 90% reduction. It was either 90 or 95% reduction in life cycle assessment emissions reduction by 2030 through its process. And just thinking about the carbon offsets of that is very helpful. But more so, it gives reason to recycling and reason for recycling to exist, because it's increasing margin both by selling new batteries or new cathode material from which is inherently low embodied carbon, which will make it more competitive amongst automotive OEMs to be able to use it, but also because it can make green credits off of that as well, or at least with the right infrastructure they can. And so the incentivizing towards using these green materials doesn't just come from the natural market factors of OEMs saying, oh, look, we're using these green materials, we really care about the environment. It's also coming from governments and from carbon markets effectively saying, this is the most efficient material for this use case, and this has the lowest embodied carbon. So they may not be producing anything particularly kind of groundbreaking in the sense of the cathode material itself. So I doubt it will go from cathode material to cell manufacturing or anything, because that doesn't seem to be where its expertise lies, and because it can only do so much with the materials it's got. So something that Ascend won't appreciate is if all of the current NMC batteries that are in circulation suddenly become a little bit useless because every other vehicle and every other OEM is suddenly using lithium iron phosphate batteries and its future derivatives, because of ease of setting up supply chain, because of cost, because of improved technical characteristics. It will just be joining every other recycler in being left with just a mountain of nickel and cobalt that is going to flood the market and keep prices kind of depressed for a very, very long time. So it's an interesting short story, at least, of this is a good route for recycling to be going, and it's nice to see that a company is realizing that, but it needs to plan ahead to be able to recycle LFP batteries in a commercially viable way, because most companies aren't particularly interested in it.
That's what I was going to ask you next, Connor. Are there any other companies looking to do this? Because I guess when I'm talking about recycling, I can't help but think of steel, right? One of the two major methods of manufacturing steel today is recycling scrap steel, just taking steel, melting it again to build its properties back up, shipping it into place. Do you think battery technology will go down a similar path, where in the future we'll see a great percentage of the supply coming through a recycling route?
The problem with that in the immediate future is the scaling of the industry. So the steel industry is charitably ancient. So countries have produced steel for years because it's a primary construction material and every country needs it. It's a strategic industry in most countries as well, so it's heavily subsidized for it to exist. Unless you're the UK, at which point you allow the biggest steel manufacturing plant to go bust, but that's not a point. Or to kind of be taken down for a long period of time. Regardless, that's difficult because of the scaling up of the industry. It's difficult because of the scaling up of the battery industry, because the rate at which it is growing is problematic. And in that, recycling will not contribute a significant proportion of supply for a long time yet. We're not talking about it contributing a significant amount of supply this decade. I won't say it'll even contribute a significant amount of supply prior to 2035. And even it might even be even later than that. It depends on end-of-life batteries, A, making it to a recycling heap. There is a commercial incentive for that, but it's not there yet, and it'll need incentivizing. And then it needs for there to be a commercial reasoning for it. And so these materials need to be worth a significant amount still well into the future. And that's why shifting chemistries could be problematic, because as of right now, nickel and cobalt are very, very low cost, relatively speaking. And while there is a significant amount of them, or there will be in batteries that will be recycled in the future because of the previous inefficiencies of such, then it will sell for something, but it might flood the market. When we're talking about the use of nickel and particularly cobalt, when we're talking about recycling of cobalt, that is its primary market. We're talking about, like, most of the cobalt that is mined goes into batteries. But if it's no longer going into batteries, and you suddenly have a massive influx of cobalt from recycled sources, what's the commercial reason for it? Your other point on steel is that when it comes to recycling batteries, you don't want to transport lithium batteries anywhere if you can help it. You want to build it where it's sold, or you transport it in a vehicle, because they're pretty volatile things as they are right now. And so international shipping isn't a big thing. And so the EU right now still isn't particularly, it's reticent to classify black mass properly. Because if they classify it as they want to, as a hazardous material, that means that the EU won't be importing it from anywhere else for recycling, which means it won't make up, which puts a dent in recyclers' plans, because they no longer have the option to recycle batteries from abroad. They have to work with European supply. And that's not going to realize anytime soon. I think most battery companies that exist right now, unless they have a special hook, like extremely efficient recycling from a life cycle assessment point of view, from an emissions perspective, most of them will likely go bust because they're simply too early. They'll either go bust or the IP will be purchased by an automotive OEM, which will be doing it in-house on its own manufacturing scrap, because that's the only significant supply of end-of-use batteries is the ones that automotive OEMs have messed up, that aren't functional for whatever reason, that need recycling to be turned into a usable one. So that's my outlook on the recycling industry for the time being. Moving on to, moving on to a couple short items from this week's issue. So there's been a leaked draft from the European Commission, which has said that the European Union only plans to reach 90% grid electrification by 2040.
To be honest, there was a leaked draft, and since then, it actually, I think they published it as well, and none of us chose to write about it because the EU is sort of annoying and depressing. It looks like they have published a new 2040 strategy, 90% emissions reduction by 2040 relative to 1990. I don't know. It's just another interesting thing that's happened pretty recently is that they seem to have ruled out placing import restrictions on Chinese modules. Again, I would need to look into that a bit more. It's kind of next week's topic.
That's a pretty big thing, just because that, I think, will probably be the case with the electric vehicle industry as well. So what we're seeing is Europe both backing off on antagonizing China and backing off on its particular climate commitments, which weirdly are two very opposing views, because China is the country producing all of the green and renewable technology as of right now. And so if it was going to be kind of reneging and slowing down on its renewable generation targets, surely it would have more leeway to antagonize China from a security perspective. So, because if it could afford to slow down its own domestic, if it could afford to antagonize its relationship with China and make imports more expensive, surely that means that it is happy to slow down its personal targets. These are two very opposing decisions coming in the same week of one another.
Like what I said with Australia and the carrot and the stick, well, Europe, like Australia, is probably might be in an even weaker position than Australia to start a trade conflict with China. They have some leverage, but they're not in a terribly happy place economically. And then also with the carrot, do they have spare money to throw around? Maybe not.
There has been a lot of investment with regard to that, but not enough investment for Europe's particular. I would say that Europe is in a worse position, but for two particular reasons. The first one mostly being that Europe is a much larger demand center than Australia. So the scale of decarbonization that is required, I don't have the electricity demand figures to hand, but Europe will comfortably dwarf Australia just with Germany alone. And that's ignoring other significant electricity consumers like France and Eastern Europe looking to increase fairly significantly. But also just because it's in a weaker place right now, specifically because of the Russian war in Ukraine. So it's
Meanwhile, Australia is a gas exporter.
Yes, Australia is a gas exporter. It has ample it has its own resource base, is another thing as well. So Australia has all the minerals to do what it needs to do. It just doesn't have the technology licensing or the kind of nascent industry to be able to just fall back on and revive that's been, after it's already been killed by China. Australia has.
Plus, if Europe wants to invest in renewable energy, instead of trying to invest 15 years too late into something that China's already taken over, just invest in hydrogen, I suppose.
Well, that's a thought.
I think the last thought on this for me is just going to be, I think none of us wrote on this, not because Europe is depressing, but because a lot of what Europe says right now doesn't really mean a ton. So one of the other things I was looking at with regards to this week's worth notings is that it's promising to kind of support the development of domestic industry manufacturing. No, it isn't. It's been saying that for the last 10 to 15 years and it hasn't really done that. So a lot of what Europe says isn't to be taken particularly seriously right now, and when it is, you'll be the first to hear about it. So keep listening in for next week's issue. And so, yeah, with that, we'd like to say goodbye for now, and for you to tune in again next week. Goodbye for now.